Lots of companies have wellness programs these days, but do they work? One of the biggest studies to date is happening right here in Illinois. We find out their research so far. And in McLean County, Democrats are trying to gain traction in a sea of red. But within all that red, there's actually lots of different shades, says outgoing GOP chair Chuck Erickson.
I mean, you have factions in every party. You have factions in the Democrat Party. You have factions in the Republican Party. You can't change that in a party.
WGLT's Ryan Denham joins us to talk about the challenge to define political parties in Bloomington and beyond. But first, remember this.
To all beef, patty, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun. You deserve a break today at McDonald's.
The restaurant's come a long way since then. We'll hear about their history in Illinois and what the chain has planned. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The fast food giant McDonald's is arguably one of, if not the best known brands in the world. In some cities, you can barely go a block without seeing those glowing yellow arches. When McDonald's sold its 100 millionth hamburger in 1958, Oak Park native Ray Kroc probably could have only imagined what the company would look like 60 years later. And today, McDonald's is looking towards the future. After a decade apart, you might have seen the headlines yesterday that McDonald's is partnering with Disney for toys in their Happy Meals. We want to ask today how much going back to Disney symbolizes an evolution for this iconic homegrown brand. But there are other changes, too. Since 1971, McDonald's has been based in suburban Oak Brook, but they recently announced that their headquarters will be moving to Chicago, to the trendy Fulton Market District on the city's near west side. It's also decided to demolish the McDonald's Museum in Des Plaines, which has been there since the 1980s, when one of the Kroc's first McDonald's from the 50s was turned into a museum. We're going to have more on that in a minute, but let's start with the Chicago Tribune's business reporter Greg Trotter, who covers McDonald's. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for having me.
So, Greg, the big McDonald's headline yesterday was that McDonald's Happy Meals have reunited with Disney for Happy Meal toys. This hasn't happened since The Little Mermaid, to give everyone a sense of how long ago this passed. How big of a deal is this?
I think it's more, you know, in the grand scheme of things, from my perspective, it's just one of many, many changes that they're doing, that they're trying to incorporate now. So I don't know that that, to me, stands out as is that big of a deal. But, I mean, when you look at it in the full context of what they're trying to do, you know, they announced, I think it was last week, that they're, you know, making some changes to try to make the Happy Meals healthier. So they're taking out the cheeseburger. They're going to stop the chocolate milk so they can reformulate it to be healthier. There's that taken in conjunction with recently unveiling its new value menu in restaurants. They're expanding delivery throughout the U.S.
Right. So lots of, it sounds like lots of changes, Greg. Yeah. In terms of the, yes, in terms of the Happy Meal change, I wondered how much it symbolized just sort of a change for McDonald's in terms of health. I know Disney originally pulled away because they felt like Happy Meals were not a healthy option for children. And McDonald's has, as you've mentioned, how much has McDonald's changed, especially its children's menu, over the years to respond to those concerns from different interest groups and other people who say that they think it's not a healthy choice for children?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they've definitely made some significant changes there. I mean, you can, you know, get the apple slices now with the Happy Meal that's been in place for a while now. I think that there are still, you know, they've definitely made significant moves and very publicly announced moves to make the Happy Meals healthier. On the other hand, I mean, they're still very much in the business of selling cheeseburgers and fries. So this is not like, you know, it's not becoming a health food place by any means. I mean, that's where they make their money, is selling cheeseburgers. And, you know, they're not bashful about that either. So, I think it's you got to sort of look at that larger context as well.
Right. And then I wonder how much you see McDonald's facing pressure. This has certainly been part of the story of the chain from other, not just fast casual places, but other healthier fast options for people. How much do you think the company is sort of positioning itself to respond to those sorts of changes within the industry?
Right. I mean, I think that's the big picture, and that's, you know, this turnaround under CEO Steve Easterbrook, a couple years in now. That's what much of this has to do with. I mean, they were feeling the pressure from those fast casual restaurants. So they're trying to improve the experience. They're trying to improve the quality of the food, all while offering value. You know, it's the value menus, the good deals is what gets people in the doors, but they want to have kind of more premium offerings like the signature crafted sandwiches, for example, so that's where they get a little bit more profit margin once they get people in the door.
And I know you have spoken to the McDonald's U.S. president, Chris Kapinski,
yeah.
And as well as CEO Steve Easterbrook. Where do you see them taking the company now?
Well, just to be clear, I have actually not spoken with Easterbrook, but I did sit down
with Kapinski.
With Kapinski and had an interesting talk. And I think it's, you know, the pace of change is going to continue to accelerate. They have big plans. They're investing this year $2.4 billion in capital projects. Most of that is going to be for converting the U.S. locations or another 4,000 U.S. restaurants to what they call the experience of the future restaurants, so that the ordering kiosks, table service, more use of the mobile app. So that's all part of the plan, and they're planning on overhauling all U.S. restaurants by 2020 into this new format. And one local example, you know, you talked about earlier, the moving the headquarters and raising the Des Plaines Museum. They're also major remodeling of the Rock and Roll McDonald's here in River North in Chicago. A familiar landmark to many people. And so it's going to be completely different when it reopens later this summer. But it's, you know, the architect is the same architect that designed the Chicago Riverwalk. And so it's pretty striking if you've seen some of the renderings, what they're trying to do there. But that's going to be one, like, very large, bold example of these experience of the future restaurants.
And I think that's a really familiar landmark for anyone who visits Chicago,
yeah.
Knowing that Rock and Roll McDonald's. It's right there in the middle of the downtown, and it's something I think when you're coming off the highway, a lot of people, you know, you drive right by it. If you're getting back on 9094, you can see it right there. And when I wanted to ask you about the makeup of the technology inside those restaurants. So now, for example, I know if it's a McDonald's franchise store, in downtown Chicago on Chicago Avenue, when you go in, they have mm-hmm. kiosks now for you to order. And then they really only have it sort of set up now where you can order with the kiosk. You don't necessarily, they only have like maybe two registers for you to speak to people. And then they have sort of two rows of kiosks. Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean about sort of how the technology of McDonald's, how they're changing the insides of their restaurants?
Yeah, exactly. It's like the touch screen kind of tablet almost format. But yeah, that's what they're rolling out. I mean, that's what they call their experience of the future. That's just sort of their personal, their company jargon for it. But yeah, I mean, the kiosks, you can still order at the counter, but a lot of the ordering will be done through the kiosks. And, you know, the idea is with the new value menu, you'll be able to sort of mix and match on the kiosk, and that's going to help drive sales. I think Taco Bell recently announced that it's following suit and it's going to start rolling out these similar kind of kiosks. So that may be the way forward. But I mean, you know, just, you know, looking at the big picture again, it's really interesting because when you talk about the company raising the Des Plaines Museum and moving headquarters and major remodeling of the Rock and Roll McDonald's, you know, no longer will we see those big yellow arches, you know, there. It's the company is very deliberately sort of breaking with some of its nostalgia of the past, and it's really trying to position the company for future growth. And so that's what a lot of these initiatives are about, from delivery to the Happy Meals to, you know, the futuristic, more futuristic restaurants. Recently set recycling goals, so all McDonald's are going to, you know, recycle packaging here in the years to come. This is all part of the business trying to grow into the future and sort of not, you know, kind of break from some of the stagnancy of its past, I think.
Right. That's Greg Trotter. He's a Chicago Tribune business reporter who covers the food industry. I want to bring someone else into this conversation. Greg was mentioning the past. Philip Moore is with the Des Plaines History Center. And that's, we mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, the McDonald's Museum there that is being raised. Philip, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us as well.
Good morning, Nyla.
Good morning. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about the history of McDonald's in Des Plaines. That McDonald's, it used to be kind of a big destination in your town, right?
Yes, it really was, and to some degree still has been in recent times. It was Ray Kroc's first McDonald's franchise and the place where he kind of launched his McDonald's empire and eventually took over the entire corporation and built it from there. It was his proving ground for modern ideas about efficiency in food service. Greg mentioned value several times. That was very important to Ray Kroc. And Kroc put this McDonald's at an ideal location for this new idea. It's at the intersection of some very busy streets here in Des Plaines. River Road, Rand Road, and Lee Street all come together in this area. And that was very important when you consider, you know, the 1950s, the 1960s, and forward. This is how people are getting around. They're driving. And it was a place where you could drive into the parking lot. You could order from the window and then sit on kind of park bench style seating outdoors or sit in your car. It was a great affordable date for young couples. So it got right into youth culture there. And so it really became an important part of our landscape.
And when did Des Plaines, Philip, decide to close the restaurant and turn it into a museum?
So the original franchise there was closed in the early 80s. McDonald's decided to build an updated McDonald's franchise across the street, still carrying franchise number one. And they were thinking about tearing down that first building, which had been altered to have some indoor seating, new signage, that sort of thing. And in the early 80s, there was a bit of a push to preserve that original location. And so in 1985, which was just after Ray Kroc passed away, they reconstructed that original building, almost a perfect replica of the 1955 version.
Was that controversial?
And that is operated as a museum.
Yeah, was that a controversial?
It's not the original structure. It's a reconstruction of the original structure. And so it's the closest we have to something to preserve from that first franchise. And it operated as a museum, a place where people can walk up and see what the original kitchen would have looked like. They had some exhibits in the basement, but it came in and out of operation because it's unfortunately in a very bad place as far as flooding along the Des Plaines River goes.
Right. And so I know, I understand for
so
a time, Philip.
It,
yeah, it sounds like it was shut for a time. I wonder.
It was.
Yeah. So now that I wonder how people in Des Plaines are feeling now about the entire thing being demolished. Are there mixed feelings?
There are mixed feelings. Some people are sad. There's a lot of people that remember those early days. Some of them even knew Ray Kroc, and some of the very first people who worked there are still around. And there's people who see, you know, this is Des Plaines' attachment to really a worldwide history story. There's some people who don't see McDonald's, the corporation, as playing part in community building in Des Plaines, and so they couldn't carry either way. The History Center would have liked to see it preserved, whether by the corporation, by the Historical Society, by the City of Des Plaines. We looked at what kind of partnerships we could form. We talked with the McDonald's Corporation, but they are moving forward, as Greg was saying, and so there's just no room in the new branding for the structure.
Phil, we're almost out of time, but I wonder if really quickly you can just let me know, as we've been talking about the McDonald's of the past and the future, how that makes you feel if they're sort of leaving all of this behind.
It does make me sad. I really wish that we could have this touchstone of kind of our modern food in the Des Plaines landscape. But we're moving on. We've collected archives and objects from McDonald's to continue telling that story here at the Des Plaines History Center. So maybe we'll have an exhibit sometime in the near future.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. That's Philip Moore with the Des Plaines History Center, explaining a little bit more about that. Greg, we're almost out of time, but just really quickly, I wonder if you can just weigh in. When is the big move happening into downtown for McDonald's headquarters? What's the timing of that, moving from Oak Brook?
They have not actually said a specific time yet. Just later this spring is all they've said thus far.
All right. So we'll see more changes ahead for one of Illinois' best-known companies, McDonald's. Greg Trotter covers McDonald's for the Chicago Tribune. He also covers the food industry. I want to thank him, as well as Philip Moore with the Des Plaines History Center. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in to our show. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We talk a lot about politics on the 21st. Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Libertarians, and Greens. For you third-party folks out there, tomorrow we're going to be spending time talking about both the Libertarian and Green parties of Illinois. But today, we're focusing on the big two, Republicans and Democrats. And these days especially, what do those terms really mean? You probably have some idea if you're a registered voter. You may even identify as a member of either party. But in reality, there are a lot more shades of red and blue than those maps on cable news can ever convey. Party leaders know this, and they're struggling with how broadly they want to define themselves, especially after the last presidential election, which really shook things up within both parties. And this is becoming clear, especially in Bloomington and McLean County in central Illinois. While historically dominated by Republicans, the next election has that party facing a new set of challengers. Democrats energized by President Trump's election. Libertarians are on the local ballots for the first time. All this, plus the local GOP chair and McLean County board member Chuck Erickson announced last month he's not seeking another term. Just how big should their metaphorical tent really be? That's the question WGLT reporter and digital content director Ryan Denham has been asking for some recent reporting that he's doing. And he's with me now from our partner station, WGLT Studios in Normal. Hi, Ryan. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
So in your report, which we'll tweet out, so this is the first half. You did two of these, right? You did the Republican Party. You're doing the Democratic Party. That's going to be up at WGLT.org tomorrow. You talk about some of the potential for shakeup in this historically very Republican area. For those of us in the rest of the state who are listening to this so they can understand, how red do things run in Bloomington Normal?
Well, it's pretty red. On the McLean County Board here, Republicans have a 15-5 majority. Every countywide elected official is a Republican, and all of our locally elected state lawmakers are Republican. Unlike like Champaign, Urbana, and Peoria that have Democratic state representatives, we don't have that. It's all Republicans. So while we're pretty evenly split in terms of Cubs and Cardinals fans, less of a divide here with the elected officials.
I was going to say, speaking of Cubs fans, it's important to point out for transparency and full disclosure purposes that your boss, who is a Cubs fan, WGLT's general manager, R.C. McBride, is also a member of the Normal Town Council, and he's a Democratic Party precinct committee man. Ryan, did R.C. have any editorial input into your stories, or does he into WGLT's newsroom's political coverage?
No, we have a pretty thick firewall between management and the newsroom.
Okay, so I just want to make that clear for all of our listeners. Prior to Governor Rauner, the last major Republican candidate for governor, State Senator Bill Brady, is from Bloomington. Can I ask about the political influence on the rest of the state, how significant that is?
Sure, yeah. You mentioned Bill Brady, but there are some others, too, that have sort of emerged statewide. As you remember, Pat Brady is the former Illinois Republican Party chairman. He actually grew up in Bloomington. Jason Berrickman is another one to keep an eye on. He's a state senator out of Bloomington Normal here, and he emerged as the Republican, one of the lead Republican negotiators on the state education funding reform last year. And he's sort of another example of one of these moderate Republicans that's emerged from Bloomington Normal onto the statewide scene.
Right. So I think it's accurate to say that the Republican Party within Bloomington has a pretty big sway over the rest of the state. Do you think that's a fair characterization?
Yes, definitely. Looking at history, that's the case.
And now, despite this longstanding influence, there's a sense, though, that Democrats are sort of right around the corner here and trying to at least make some challenges and inroads. Can you tell us about what that's looking like in this election year?
Yeah, so what we're seeing here in McLean County is sort of interesting. We have two incumbent Republican state lawmakers, Dan Brady and Keith Sommer. They haven't had a general election contest in some time, and they both will have Democratic challengers in November. Dan Brady actually has a Republican primary challenger as well. We're seeing 11 of 13 county government races being contested, which is like really unusual for us. Usually those are one candidate on the ballot type situations. There's some other kind of signs a little closer to ground level on the Democratic side that are interesting. Precinct committeeman is an interesting barometer to watch for us. Toward the end of Obama's administration, Democrats here had less than a quarter of these precinct committeeman slots filled. These are sort of your ground troops if you're getting out the vote and trying to build a party from the ground up. Now, there are more Democratic precinct committeemen here than Republican precinct committeemen. And that's, they've more than doubled their ground level troops on the Democratic side, which is interesting.
Right. And I wonder what is sort of the idea about this. I mean, we're hearing all across the state and all across the country about motivation for this because of a Trump administration. Is that the same thing you're hearing from Democrats in McLean County?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly it. I think that the Trump election was a jolt for a lot of these local Democrats, and now they're starting to think about how do they make this energy that they have more of a permanent shift, right? Because they could, there could be a day when Trump is no longer president, or what if a lot of these Democrats lose in November? So what can they do structurally to make this a bit of a more permanent arrangement?
I know you spoke with a Democratic Precinct Committee woman, Sally Pancrazio. Did I pronounce that correctly? Is it Pancrazio?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, let's hear what Sally had to say.
They are more issue-oriented than party-oriented. They need to be respected, and we need to listen to them, and we need to come together on an area of common good for all of us.
That's Sally Pancrazio. She's a Democratic precinct committee woman, well-known political leader in McLean County. Ryan, that's, I think, we're hearing this from a lot of Democrats, not just across the state, but the country, about people being more issue-oriented than party-oriented. How is the Democratic Party handling that?
Well, that's going to be the interesting turn here, because the Democrats and the Republicans both will have elections for their new party chairs coming up in April, and both of them have these factions that they're dealing with. On the Democratic side, these factions are are pretty clear. So you've got the union history, which the unions have sort of been the backbone of the local Democrats, but now they're in these new factions like progressive activists, such as the Indivisible Groups, Voices of Reason, those kinds of folks. And then you've got women, a lot of first-time women candidates who are coming into the mix. You've got voters who vote on the LGBT issues, and that's their top issue. You have college Democrats, because we have two college campuses here in our community. So we've got all these factions, and the new Democratic leader is going to have to kind of resolve how big that tent is going to be moving forward, especially with these issue-oriented independents who are sort of in the middle.
And Ryan, of course, speaking with WGLT's Ryan Denham from Normal, that's also what we've seen with the Republican Party for some time, being issue-oriented. How is the GOP party in McLean handling this?
So on the Republican side, the factions are, it's a little clearer cut. So there's a contingent that is most interested in social issues, and then the dividing line is between social issues and economic issues. And the Republican Party here is it seems interested in how much to steer in the direction of social issues, right? So even if you are very conservative on issues like abortion or, the death penalty, gun control, that kind of stuff, you know, how much should the party wrap around itself in that messaging of those social issues? So currently, the Republican Party chair in McLean County has dived right into those social issues. Just to give like one example, the first month of 2018, there were like 11 or 12 different Facebook posts on the party's Facebook page about the national anthem NFL players kneeling issue. Is that really a dominant number one issue for Republicans in this area? There's some questions about that. Why is that an issue that's being messaged on so heavily? Whereas the more moderate Republicans are more interested in economic issues. They say they can have a better chance at reaching young voters by sticking to pocketbook issues, jobs, economy, that kind of stuff.
And I know you mentioned Pat Brady. You spoke to him. He's the former Illinois GOP chair. Let's hear what he had to say about this issue.
The my way or the highway when running a party doesn't work. You need to appeal to a broad group, but you also got to keep in mind, you got to be a little forward-looking on where the electorate is going. Not that you compromise your principles, but young people on these social issues don't care. They are more concerned with fiscal issues, where they're going to get a job, how they're going to pay down their student loan debt. The social issues are far less important. I'm not minimizing those, but you got to realize that it's not 1950 anymore, and we need to be a party of 2020, not 1955. And I think some of the ideologues get caught up in that, and then the effect of it is we lose elections.
That's the former chair of the Illinois GOP, Pat Brady, speaking with WGLT's Ryan Denham, who's in studio with me now at our partner station in Normal, talking about this issue. And Ryan, as I mentioned, there's a new search for a new chairman for the GOP in your area. How is that illustrative of this situation right now?
Sure. So I think the messaging side of this is really important. There have been two candidates that have emerged as likely successors to Chuck Erickson, who is the current chair, who's stepping down after a couple of terms. And for both of these candidates, they're messaging and communicating what the party stands for in a very different way. One of them is actually majored in communications and theater in college, and she's presents a much softer view of Republican principles than her predecessor might be. On the other side, there's a Normal town council member who's also interested in running for chair. And he, too, has a bit of a softer sell and is focused more on economic issues, local issues, and not these more divisive social issues.
And, Ryan, I guess the question of how big a party tent should be and who a party will officially endorse is kind of a big question here. And we're seeing this, obviously, not just within in the Bloomington area. We're seeing this when the Democratic Party, with the really contentious race that's shaping up outside of Chicago between longtime incumbent Congressman Dan Lipinski and newcomer Marie Newman. And it is over this issue in some ways of abortion. I wonder, the National Democratic Party, in the case of Lipinski, he opposes abortion. They're refusing to endorse him. In California, Democrats aren't endorsing Senator Dianne Feinstein for another term. We saw those the state Democratic Party. We saw that news this weekend. How much of this is about ideology or both parties really just trying to find a direction?
Yeah, that's really interesting how that's playing out at every level of politics. So you mentioned the race, the Senate race in California, the House race out of Chicago. That's actually my home district where I grew up. And then in McLean County, we have it even on like the county board level. So a very low level of politics. But one of our longtime Democratic county board members is facing a primary challenge from one of these kind of progressive activists, a woman, first-time candidate. And you know, his list of endorsements includes a ton of Republican names. He touts his ability to kind of cross the aisle on a lot of issues, but his opponent is saying, we don't want an aisle crosser. We want somebody who's you know, going to fight for these kind of progressive ideals, even at a county level. So it's a real interesting fight taking place on all levels.
And Ryan, we just have about a minute left. So if you could quickly answer, I think people might be listening thinking, who cares about the party chair or leadership? Why do you think it matters?
That's a great point. Who does care? But I think ultimately what it means is the better organized a local party is, the higher probability that local candidates from that party will get elected, right? So in our area, county board deals with a lot of important issues, the criminal justice system, mental health issues, solid waste, garbage, wind farms, wind energy. If you have more Democrats or more Republicans on these boards, you're going to see the issues steer one direction or the other in a lot of cases. A 15-5 majority, which the Republicans have now, that really matters when you're making policy decisions.
That's WGLT's Ryan Denham. He's been doing a lot of reporting on this in the Bloomington Normal area. We're going to tweet out his stories, the one that's already out. There'll be another one tomorrow. Ryan, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
As Ryan's saying, when it comes to what voters care about, this is an important issue, and we want to hear from you. Maybe you're listening and you're thinking, I would like to weigh in on what the GOP or the Democratic Party should stand for. We always welcome your calls and tweets during the program, of course, but we're unveiling a new way for you to get in touch with us, what we hope will inform a series of reporting about this issue for this election year. So I want to welcome Kristen Walters. She's our Illinois Newsroom Engagement Strategist here at Illinois Public Media. She just started and she's in studio with me. Hey, Kristen, thanks for being here.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you.
So maybe you should explain first what the Illinois Newsroom is for everyone who doesn't know about it.
Sure. So the Illinois Newsroom is a journalism collaboration between six public media stations across the state. And it's really the commitment of public media to create long-form, in-depth journalism. And here, just like the 21st show, hear voices from all across the state on statewide issues. So hearing from all parts of the state.
So we're going to be working with you guys. The 21st is going to be working with the Illinois Newsroom as we're talking about identity politics and defining political parties. And as we've been talking about what makes a party in Bloomington, we wanted to reach out to all of our listeners throughout the state, not just in Bloomington and McLean County. Of course, we welcome everybody there, too. But as you're listening and want to weigh in, we have a new way for them to share their thoughts about this. Kristen, can you explain?
Sure. So if you go onto the 21st site, you can you'll see a comment box, a question box. And so you'll input your question there about or your comment about the Illinois identity politics.
Right. So our question we're asking very simply on our website is, what do you think the Republican or Democratic Party should stand for? And Kristen, you're helping us implement this tool as people answer those questions. We're going to be using that in our reporting.
Absolutely. So we're integrating community feedback and input into the editorial process, into the reporting. So we want to make sure that we are directly answering the questions of the people who we're serving our information to.
Right. So we've started by asking you a question. And so the question for all of you listening, if you'd like to weigh in, is what do you think the Republican or Democratic Party is standing for? But Kristen, as you pointed out, there's an option in there for you to pose questions for us to ask.
Yes. So you should do both. You should answer the incredible question so we can hear from you and follow up about your thoughts. And then also, if you have questions about what's going on about the future of the Democratic and Republican Party, we can follow up on that as well.
Or any other questions about the election. If there are other questions you'd like us to ask, we will look at it. Our partners at the Illinois Newsroom will look at that as well. So they can just head to 21stshow.org. We've got lots of election stuff up there. there. We've got our money tracker from ProPublica Illinois. But if you go just right to the right of the page on 21stshow.org, you can see this question and you can answer that. Kristen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla.
As I said, tomorrow we're also going to be talking about third parties in Illinois with representatives from the Libertarian Party of Illinois and the Green Party. All of this information you can weigh in at our website, 21stshow.org. Thanks.
The 21st is made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, presenting Organizing with Love in a Time of Hate, March 6th at 4 p.m. at Spurlock Museum. Author, activist, and thought leader Ai-Jen Poo will speak about the current political climate and the potential for change. cas.illinois.edu.
Listening to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have you participated in a wellness program at your job? They're all the rage these days. The concept: employers help their workers become healthier, and that means healthier people become more productive. In the U.S., wellness is a big industry. As much as $8 billion are spent on these programs, which are offered to 50 million Americans. So researchers at the University of Illinois took their employee base of more than 12,000 workers to undertake a multi-year study of wellness programs. It's called iThrive. And in the interest of full disclosure, as I've said many times in the past, our home station, Illinois Public Media, is part of the University of Illinois. And 2 years ago, I signed up for this study, and I'm still in it, along with many coworkers in the WILL newsroom. Some of the initial results are out from this, and as it turns out, they relate to the incentives that are offered to workers who participate in the program. In other words, how much money do you have to pay someone to participate in a wellness program? And does the money matter? Principal Investigator David Molitor is in our studio right now with me to talk about this. Hi, David. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
So, David, I think first we should say there might be people who are listening thinking, is Nyla screwing up this study by talking about it and having you here? So I probably we should start with that.
Sure. Well, I won't be able to. Thank you for being a participant in this study.
This is very meta, I imagine.
That's right.
Right.
I won't be able to comment on your specific outcomes because all of our data are anonymized. I should also add that all of the results that we'll talk about today are part of a recent release, a first release of results that can be found on our website at www.nber.org/workplace wellness.
And we'll tweet that out as well. And just to sort of go through what the study was, the University of Illinois is actually a big employer. What's the kind of the design of or the design of this study that you all have created?
Yeah, so workplace wellness programs have become prevalent across the United States, and over 50 million American workers are covered by these, and the programs vary across employers. But there are a few major components of workplace wellness studies. These include biometric health screenings. So these are screenings that happen in person on the campus by a medical professional that measure your height, weight, cholesterol, glucose, and tell you about your health. Another major component of wellness programs is to offer what are called health risk assessments. So these are survey questionnaires that ask you about your lifestyle and try to help identify health risks. And the third component of wellness programs you might refer to as wellness activities. So these are activities that help you to reduce health risks that were identified in the screening or the health risk assessment. Might be things like smoking cessation, Weight Watchers, or activity programs.
And you actually teach finance. You're in the business school at University of Illinois. How did you get interested in this?
So I'm trained as an economist. So I study how incentives affect people's choices. And I first became interested in wellness programs when I was a postdoc. And the university where I was at the time had a very comprehensive wellness program. I was participating in that program, and I became interested in whether these programs worked.
And I guess that's the interesting thing. When you and I chatted before the show about this, you mentioned we talked about the popularity of wellness programs. But when we look at the research out there, is there a lot of research into how effective these programs are?
There are many studies that have looked at the effects of workplace wellness programs, and many of them find that wellness programs reduce healthcare costs, that they reduce the number of days that employees report sick, that they increase productivity. Now, a limitation of most of these studies is that they generally compare outcomes between employees who choose to participate in the wellness program relative to employees who choose not to participate. And so it's often observed that participants look healthier, but it's not clear whether the wellness program made them healthier or whether they were healthy to begin with.
Right, because it stands to reason that someone who is interested in health would be interested in a wellness program.
Yeah, if you're offered...
So you kind of already self-select, right?
If you're offered $100 to go to the gym, that's really attractive if you're already going to the gym. Might as well cash in on that incentive.
But you all looked at this, and the way this study is set up is you actually have it set up so you can look at people who are interested in the program, but you've sort of set up this trial to determine people who have similar amounts of interest but maybe not similar amount of incentives.
Yeah, so the key innovation of our study was to implement a wellness program as a randomized controlled trial. Now, that term actually comes from the medical literature when they try to see if a new medical treatment is effective, and they randomly assign some people to the new treatment and some people to the old treatment to see if it works. So we did the same thing, except that what we randomized was eligibility, whether or not you were eligible to participate in our comprehensive wellness program. So what this means is that those who were invited versus those who were not were, on average, very similar in characteristics at baseline. So then we can compare over time whether those who were invited to the program, first of all, how many of them participate, and then also do their outcomes differ from those who are in the control group.
So I was invited to the program. I realized I'm not going to say which group I'm in because I realized after talking to David which control group they have put me in. But you are offered different things, like you're offered an opportunity to take like Tai Chi or participate in Weight Watchers, or there's like an online app. But the whole point of this, what you're looking at, David, is how much money you're paying people. Like you mentioned the $100 to go to the gym. What have you all found so far about offering money to people? How much of it does that really make a difference?
Yeah, so many employers struggle to get their employees to participate in their wellness program. And so it has become increasingly common to offer incentives to try to encourage people to participate.
So we know because we know that they work, right? So I guess the question is, how do we get more people involved with them?
Yeah, so the question is, how do we get, if we think the wellness program works, then actually that's an open question. Does it actually have the intended effects that people hope it does? But at a first step, you have to get people in the door. You have to get people participating. And if you have low participation, the program is unlikely to be effective. So the first question is, do people respond to incentives to participate? And the way we studied this is that we varied the level of incentive.
And by incentive, you mean money, right?
Yeah, so we offered rewards for completing different steps of the program. And the first step of the program was to complete an in-person health screening. And it was free to everyone in the program. It was free to get the health screening. And some people were offered, in addition to the free screening, they would be offered $100 or $200 for completing that screening. Now, what we found was very interesting because for people who were offered a free screening with no incentive, for every 10 people we invited, nearly 5 of them showed up, which means that a lot of people are interested in taking advantage of these screening programs that happen in a convenient location. They don't have to go to the doctor. They can just walk downstairs or a nearby building and get a screening. So many employees took up the screening without any additional incentive. Now, when we offered an extra $100, so $100 for completing the screening, instead of 5 people showing up for every 10 invited, that went up to 6. So that's a 20% increase. That's a modest but important increase in participation, meaning that the incentives seem to be working at getting people to show up. But interestingly, when we offered $200, so we went up another $100, still it was just about 6 for every 10 that were invited.
So it didn't make a difference. Yes. Extra $100 didn't make a difference.
That's right. So at some point, the additional incentives did not seem to be increasing participation. And that's, I think, really important for employers. These programs can be expensive to implement. And so an important question is, how much do you have to pay? Because paying larger incentives increase program costs. How much do you have to pay to get people to show up? In our context, it seemed like $100 was the sweet spot.
And I guess it's right. So I guess the question is, how much is it worth it for you to do these screenings? How much is it worth it for you to go to the gym? I guess what you're also trying to get at is what motivates people in this sense as well.
That's right. Yeah. So in fact, we offered, in addition to rewards for completing the screening, there were many other activities participants could complete after the screening, which included these wellness activities.
And then you get more money for that.
That's right. And there was more money. So an important question is, should we give people rewards for coming in the door up front for getting the screening, or should we have these incentives for finishing the entire program, for going all the way through the screening and finishing wellness activities? And so what we found is that the incentives tied to completing the whole program were similarly effective at getting people to show up in the first place and were much more effective at keeping people engaged in the program throughout the year.
So, as you mentioned, you're an economist. I wonder how much of this has to sort of do with the whole field of behavioral economics and how we can incentivize people to behave better. What are you hoping that HR departments or other companies can take away from what you've learned so far?
I think there are a few lessons that HR departments can take away. And the first is about how to design programs and how to design the incentives. And many HR departments have been moving toward larger and larger incentives. Our results suggest that may not be necessary. Lower incentives may be enough to get people to participate. Larger incentives may not induce much additional participation.
And so I guess the other question about this is, and this is maybe not part of necessarily the scope of your study, are you also going to be looking at how we can get people to have healthier lifestyles, or how you can get people to do stuff they don't normally want to do? Is paying them kind of the best way to do that?
Well, there's a large literature on how to get people to change behaviors. And I think introspection reveals that it's very difficult to change behaviors even when you want to.
And even when we're paying people at this rate,
that's
right?
When you talk to primary care doctors, they also say that it's hard to get their patients to change behavior. So I think this is actually a big challenge in public health in the United States, is how do we get individuals to lead healthier lifestyles? And there's been a large push to go away from the doctor's office and think about where people spend their time. People spend about a third of their life at work. And so maybe that's an important place to be encouraging healthy behaviors and creating what's called a culture of health.
And as an economist, does it concern you that money does not necessarily work in this situation? I feel like money would be what economists think would motivate everyone.
Well, you know, we find that money does have an effect on getting people to show up. It's just that it shows diminishing returns. And that's a term that means that in economics, it's used frequently to mean that a little bit goes a long way and that additional amounts maybe aren't as effective as the first amounts.
Are you surprised by the response you've gotten so far from this study, from iThrive, from people?
Well, we've had a very positive response so far, and that's encouraging to us. We worked closely with the director of well-being services here on campus to design what would be a gold standard wellness program. And so we're great, Michelle Guerra. So we're grateful for her input into the design, and we've been very pleased at the positive response of participants.
So there's about 5,000 people in this. This is a multi-year study. What's sort of the plan? Are you allowed to say what the plan is going forward in terms of your research?
Yeah. So let me tell you about, so far we're a little over 1 year into the program. And so what we've been able to do is to look at whether individuals who were invited into this wellness program, whether they're experiencing any different health outcomes or health behaviors relative to the control group that was not eligible to participate. And across many outcomes over the first year, we're not observing any differences, suggesting that the wellness program, even though we've had a lot of participation, hasn't yet moved the needle on some key outcomes. These outcomes include healthcare spending. So the healthcare spending over the first year of the program is about the same in the treatment group and the control group, and same for the number of days reported sick and a number of health behaviors. So these are outcomes that it may take a while to to change. It can take time to change behaviors that are ingrained. And so we're continuing to study these outcomes over time.
Not just time, but money, it seems like. I want to thank David Molitor. He's an assistant professor at the University of Illinois. He teaches finance. He's the principal investigator behind this workplace wellness study. If you're interested, we will tweet out their initial findings. David, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good to be here today.
As a reminder, tomorrow we're going to be talking about third parties. I mentioned that if you're a member of the Libertarian or Green Party, we want to hear from you. We want to know why you're a member of those parties. If you leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121, we can include it in our conversation tomorrow. So leave us a voicemail, 217-300-2121. You can also email us always. Our email's talk@21stshow.org. If you head to our website, 21stshow.org, that shows you how you can communicate with us. We've also, as I said, got those questions I mentioned up there about the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, and what you think they should stand for. We'd love to hear from you on that as we approach this midterm election year. All of that information, as I said, is just at our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.